Again, Romans chapter 13 is where we are, and would like to begin by reading the first seven verses of Romans 13. Again, a passage that many of you are familiar with. The Apostle Paul says, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God. And those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. You want to be unafraid of the authority, do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister, an avenger, to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers, attending continually to this very thing. Render, therefore, to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor." I think that when we look at this particular passage of Scripture, the first thing that stands out is the fact that he calls us to be obedient to the civil authorities, and that the civil authorities have a right to exist and we have a responsibility to be obedient to them, despite the fact that there were a number of times that both he, as an apostle, as well as the other apostles, found themselves in conflict with the governing authorities. So we can start by indicating what is not being established in this particular text. When the apostle indicates that the authorities that exist are appointed by God, and whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, that is not to say that just because a government exists, like for example, we today in our nation have the United States government, the federal government, that is, I suppose, the final authority with regard to our civil lives and interactions as citizens. That because it exists, indicates that it is a government that God approves of with regard to behavior, whether it be, you know, at the head of the executive branch, or whether it be with regard to the laws of the land, those kinds of things. There are a number of examples that we can give in Scripture. Again, using the life of the Apostle Paul himself, we take him as an example in his letter to the Philippians, as he wrote that letter while he was in prison in Rome. You can read the latter part of the book of Acts and read about his journey to Rome, the things which led to his arrest, and the fact that as a Roman citizen, as he made his appeal to Caesar, that he was wholly under the circumstance, whether he would be released or put to death, was wholly dependent upon the whim of Caesar himself. And as we look in history, we find that the Caesars typically were ungodly men, and they were very arrogant. They exalted themselves, and the Roman Empire itself was a corrupt empire. And so the Apostle Paul, as a Roman citizen, made his appeal to a government that in many ways was corrupt and ungodly, and no doubt was unpleasing to God as a result of the practices both of the society and the government itself. And we can look back through the history of the Jewish nation as well, a number of occasions where you find the nation of Israel and the kings being corrupt and idolatrous. You find that nations round about them, the Assyrians and the Babylonians specifically, as the two great empires that brought various parts of Israel into captivity. Those were ungodly empires, evil, violent, idolatrous. And yet God utilized them to bring judgment upon Israel, both the northern kingdom as well as Judah later. And so we're not going to say from this that those governments are, because they exist, acceptable to God or pleasing to God. But government has a place, it has a purpose. And that's what's being established in this particular text. And I think that it's significant that we look at, in verse 3, the concept concerning obedience. The rulers are not a terror to good works, but evil. And so let's just take our nation as an example and look at the United States when we talk about the laws of the land. And again, not trying to get too deep into the weeds with regard to this. We have the Constitution, first of all, which we, most of us as Americans, we will very much appreciate that document. It's an amazing document. The Bill of Rights. We look at the code of laws that exist in our society to a very great extent is a something that is beneficial to our society and helpful to us. You know, we've got a lot of conflict that exists in the world today with regard to the term that's being bandied about now is extrajudicial executions or judgments that are being basically that the police themselves talking about the Black Lives Matter movement and things like that, that the police are going beyond their authority and they're executing criminals or executing who they deem to be criminals on the street. Setting aside the legitimacy of such criticisms and complaints, we do acknowledge the fact that there is corruption, there is evil, there are bad things that exist in our society today, and often they have as their origin either the laws of the land themselves or the representatives of those laws. And we acknowledge that that is the case. But there is a truism that is established here in verse 3 that I think we need to acknowledge and recognize. When I say a truism, what I mean by that is that it's something that is generally true. It's not always the case, but generally this is. And that is that rulers are not a terror to good works, but evil. So, as a result of that, if we want to get along in our society, the best thing for us to do is obey the laws of the land. If we obey the laws of the land, if we pay our taxes, if we don't run red lights, if we don't rob or pillage or do other things that are considered unlawful in our nation, by and large, a law-abiding citizen, as a result of being a law-abiding citizen, has no cause or reason to be afraid of authority. Instead, we are told, if you do what is good, you will receive praise from the same. And so this is a truism. This is something that is generally the case. And we won't argue against the fact that there are abuses of authority and abuses of power. But even, and I'll just state this as a general observance, even when you look on in the accounts that you'll find concerning people who have been mistreated, not always the case, but generally it is the case that either individuals were engaging in behavior that was at the very least questionable. In other words, it would be cause for someone who is in a position of authority, we'll take the police as an example, to hold them in suspicion. Because of their actions, their demeanor, because of where they are, because of who they're with, those kinds of things. Whereas individuals who aren't that way and aren't behaving in that way, generally they do not run afoul of the law. And that's kind of what we're talking about here in the third point. Well, why, or in the third verse, why is that? Well, it's explained in verse 4 of the text as to why that is the case. Because when you consider the ruling authorities, the governing authorities, the purpose of the governing authorities, and we're talking about the king, we're talking about the individual who is the lawman or whatever the case may be, he is God's minister to you for good. So this is, you know, when you talk about the laws of the land and the keepers of the law or those who enforce the law, the purpose of that is order in society. The purpose of that is to ensure that there is not an abuse of circumstances on the part of one against another. There is the need for that in society. Without that, there's anarchy. One of the things that I thought was interesting, because I keep abreast of this somewhat with regard to the politics of it, as we're in the political season. But there was on a talk show a few weeks ago, an activist who was speaking and giving her opinion of the current conflicts and racial conflict in society, and her solution to the problem was, let's abolish the police force, get rid of police, and come up with something other than police. And I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, that you'd say something as if, again, if we're living in a society that is ideal, where everybody does what's right and is concerned about one another, there is no need for police. But where has that ever existed? It's always been in the minds of some men to do evil. And as a result of that, God has appointed. It's a part of God's design. That the ruler be God's minister for good, and to recognize that if you do evil, verse 4, he doesn't bear the sword in vain. He is God's minister and avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. And so when we talk about our responsibility as Christians, again, we're discussing this from a Christian viewpoint and what God expects of us, and that sometimes can be more difficult when you're in a particular period of time or in a particular place to where these conflicts that we speak of arise. I'm not sure it's any worse than it used to be, but it just seems like it's always 24/7 news cycle on television, that kind of thing. We're at least more aware of it than what has been the case before. But the I think the important moral for us to gain from this is found in verse 5. There are two reasons why we need to be obedient to the laws of the land, to be subject to the governing authorities. Number one, because of wrath. Now what that means is, if you disobey the laws of the land in which you live, the wrath of that law and the enforcers of that law will fall upon you. So if you don't want to get in trouble with the police, then make sure you don't run red light or speed. Or, again, take a gun and rob a bank. If you don't want to get in trouble with the federal government, then make sure that you pay your taxes. And of course, that's just a couple of examples. But not only for wrath, but because these men and these ruling authorities and these laws are put into place as God has appointed them, it is your responsibility as a Christian to do that, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. And this is a principle that is not only established here, but is established in other places as well. For example, the responsibility that we have with regard to our being employees. And what is that? That we are basically to give an honest day's work for an honest day's wage, that when we are to serve, we're not to be serving as men pleasers, but rather it is our purpose to please God. So we've entered into an agreement with a boss, an employer. The employer says that if you work and you're industrious for this period of time, I'm going to pay you this amount of money. And so then the boss says, okay, get started, and he walks away. And okay, the boss isn't around, so now I don't have to work because he's not around to monitor me. And that's what a lot of people... That's why a lot of people act with regard to their work. They're only industrious when they are required, because they're held accountable. And that's what the Apostle Paul was talking about when he said, don't serve as men pleasers. Our purpose is to serve God first. And we could go on and on and on with regard to examples of this, with regard to relationships that we establish in our culture. Be they employer-employee or citizen-government or family members, those kinds of things. It's not just because it's what's going to be best for you, or because the agreement that you entered into, or because it's just right or ethical to do it, but it's because this is something that God requires of you as a child of God. So our responsibility is, is, well, everyone's responsibility is the same in that regard, but as Christians, we're held to that standard that these things are not merely a matter of wrath or consequence, but also because this is an agreement that you have made with God. This is a part of the Christian walk. And so I think verse 5 is the key to understanding this. And again, he involves this not only with regard to the sword, as indicated in verse 4 of the text, with regard to the execution of wrath against someone who breaks the law, but he specifically includes in that, in verse 6, the payment of taxes. I've told you this before. There are not many illustrations that I've not used in the time that I've been here in this regard, but there was a couple of young men when I was in Odessa, and this was I guess while I was still probably just out of high school, that they had just come from college and they were deep thinkers, and they had come to the conclusion that they shouldn't have to pay taxes. And so it was their idea that they would eventually move to Alaska, basically because if they got far enough away and were isolated enough, then the government wouldn't come after them for not paying their taxes. And there's some very convoluted reasoning, but it basically contradicted what is clearly stated here and by our Lord in Matthew chapter 22. You'll remember as he was tested and a coin was given to him, basically, you call yourself a king. What about the Roman Empire? And he said, well, whose inscription or whose image is on the coin? And they said, it's Caesar's. And his answer, Matthew 22 and 21, was render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. He basically was telling them, pay your taxes. Pay the tribute that is required of you. And so the Apostle Paul almost says it identically to that in verse 7. Render, therefore, to all their due. Taxes to whom taxes are due. Customs to whom customs. Fear to whom fear. And honor to whom honor. So this is a passage which very clearly establishes the responsibility that we as Christians have to be obedient to the government. Now there are some caveats in this that we want to make note of. Before we get into that, and I open it up to any discussion that you want to raise, I do want to note just one point in verse 4 of the text. It's a side point somewhat, but it is something that is troubling to some Christians. And the question is, basically, with regard to capital punishment, is as Christians, should we defend the concept of capital punishment? I think it is intrinsic in the passage in verse 4 of the text. This is a principle that is established with regard to God's laws. First of all, there was, for example, capital punishment that was imposed by God's law, the Mosaic law, with regard to disobedience under the Old Covenant. So it was there. The wise men, book of Ecclesiastes, indicated with regard to the wrath of the law not being executed speedily upon the disobedient, that their minds are given over to evil, indicating that it is if laws are not enforced and enforced speedily, then there is encouragement given to the lawbreaker. In fact, I'm going to get away with it, or I'm not going to be held accountable for these things, so I can do so with impunity. Which, by the way, goes back to verse 5. You know, there are some people, the only reason why they obey the laws of the land is because they are not convinced that they'll get away with it if they don't. In other words, I pay taxes not because I want to pay taxes. If I could get away without paying taxes, I'd get away with that without paying taxes. But the government's going to get me if I do, so I will pay them. And I'm going to do it because I don't want to run afoul of the government. That's the only reason. And so in those kinds of situations, if a particular circumstance comes up to where it's possible for me to steal and not be found out, it's possible for me to break any law of the land and not be caught in doing that, then I'm going to do that and be willing to do that because I can get away with it. And that's the idea that many people have today. The Christian is held to a higher standard, as indicated in verse 5 of the text. So, again, keep that in mind, that this is inclusive of taxes and other types of things. But it ends up, if you'll notice in verse 4 of the text, that the minister of God in civil government does not bear the sword in vain. Now, that phrase, the sword, is a euphemism which has reference to or is applied to that final punishment, which is death. It's not exclusively in this particular text referring to death, but it is up to and including capital punishment in this particular thing. So there is an indication of that in Romans 13 and verse 4. Okay, having said that, then, what I would like to do as a way of a discussion, first of all, open it up to any questions or comments that you might have as to what I've said up to this point, but also, let's talk a little bit, if we're to obey the government, is there any exceptions? What are the exceptions? You know, what are the limits to this command that is given here fairly clearly here in the 13th chapter? I think that's something that would be worth a little bit of discussion this morning. Okay, so questions, comments? Yes, ma'am.
Well, you touched on capital punishment, and the principle of capital punishment, as you said, is in Scripture. God ordained it. It was practiced. Whether I believe in capital punishment or you believe in capital punishment is something that you have to answer. Now, in the state of Texas, we have capital punishment that is legal. If I were in the position to actually be the one who executed that, could I do that? The individual would have to answer that question. The fact that I do believe in capital punishment, and the state of Texas believes in capital punishment, if I were to live in a state that did not have capital punishment that was legal, how could I then execute capital punishment in that state? Myself, or being even the government of that state, could it execute capital punishment? No, it's illegal. So, we have to follow the land. We can have beliefs, and in our own country, we have wicked laws that have been passed recently allowing what they define as gay marriage. Do I believe it is scriptural? No, I do not. Scripture does not believe it is scriptural. I don't believe it's scriptural. I live in a country where it's legal. Do I have to practice it? No, I do not. So, we have to, is it moral? Does it fit God's laws? We have to be subject to that law, even though we may not practice it.
Okay, so that's a good principle to establish. So, let's ask a question then in that regard. What happens if, because laws laws impact us in two ways. It some laws preclude our participation in action. If it is against the law for me to steal, setting aside the morality of it, if it's against the law for me to steal, then if I engage in the practice of stealing, I am doing something that the law prohibits. There are some laws, however, that compel. The taxes is an example of that. So, if the government tells me this is a tribute that I must pay, then I don't pay it, then I am afoul of the law because I did not do something that I am compelled to do by the law. So, what you've described in this part of our discussion is certain things in gay marriage, homosexual marriage is an example of that, to where it has been legalized. It is something that is allowed by law, but it's not compelled by law. And so as a part of that, I can maintain my obedience to the law because that law doesn't impact me. I'm not required to do something. It regulates something, but it requires something. But what about if there is a law that is passed that compels me as a Christian to engage in an activity that I find immoral or ungodly? Then what's my action? Am I still constrained to be obedient to these principles that are found here in Romans 13? Is there a limit to what it was required of me? That's the question. It's got an easy answer. Now, when you begin to get into circumstances and specific examples as to what's involved and what's not, then we may have some questions. But what's the answer to that, by the way? If the civil government compels me to do something that is sinful, what is my response?
Well, I think you can take that argument and work it the other direction. Let's say that the government abolishes marriage. said, okay, there are no more marriages. You know, we solve this issue by abolishing the institution of marriage, the legal contracts. There's no such thing anymore. Now, as a Christian, what do I do? I can't get married anymore. Well, we're going to still be married because God's law requires that, for that union to take place. So,
yeah, see, that's one of the difficult questions, because how would that be accomplished? How would we do that? And could we do that? And some would claim, in fact, I've talked with some, or read some writings from some gospel preachers who would contend that if marriage was abolished or made unlawful, or that, in other words, you could not civilly get married in a society, that a Christian would have to be celibate in that circumstance as a result of it. And basically would be, I guess it would be making... This is the problem I would have with this is what I would condemn, is it would make God's law subservient to man's law in that regard, as an example. There are some permutations. This can be somewhat difficult. Yes?
Our usual go-to passage on this subject is Acts chapter 4, Paul the Apostle before the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin told them not to preach anymore in his name. And Peter and John answered and said, whether it's right beside God, it is to you more than to God, you judge. So the matter of who he goes to, they'll listen to, and they had the right to do this. They were the civil authority in the land. And normally, if they were commanded to do something, you'd have to obey it. He says, now, when it comes between you and God, you judge which one should be listened to. And that's the difference. And this is the proof text of that.
Okay.
When civil law violates God's law, we have to follow God's law.
Okay, good point. Yes, sir. Gotcha.
Well, he kind of said where I was going to conclude, but one of the things that oftentimes gets lost in a discussion like this is the majority of the world, at least in the time of this writing, you have monarchies or dictatorships, depending. A dictatorship doesn't necessarily have to be some executive power outside of the king. A dictatorship can be a king or whatever. Generally tyrannical. The founders of this nation were... And I get to this because as Christians in America today, if we are to obey the civil government, we have to understand our civil government so we know how to obey it. What we get into is having to understand the history of our country. And like you said, we don't want to get bogged down in these things, but they're essential to understanding how we as Christians in America must act. We see that our founders were trying to get away from the monarchy, which can be tyrannical. They were trying to get away from tyranny. Well, what did they do? We split off from Britain. When any government official in Britain enters office, they more or less give oath to the Queen, the monarch. When we as American citizens, if we were to enter the government, we too have to take an oath of office. What do we swear to? We swear to the ultimate authority in this country. Now, that's God aside, but that is the Constitution. No government official in this country has authority but for the Constitution. The Constitution is where these branches derive their powers. So, with that understanding, the highest power in the land is the Constitution. We all must understand it so that we know how to hold our representatives accountable. Now, that being said, as you mentioned earlier, there's this section of that called the Bill of Rights. The Constitution was not necessarily meant to be all governed, as Brad alluded to. It, or all powerful, as Brad alluded to, there's states. States basically being many nations. If you think about the Articles of Confederacy, what is a confederacy? An agreement between different smaller nations or individual nations. Well, we are an interestingly modified version of that. We are a union of essentially the same things. Well, not all states agree on all things. Like you said, you have capital punishment here, you have capital punishment there. You have to abide by the law of the land. Well, constitutionally, that's allowed, in fact, that's expected by the Constitution.
I'm getting your point. I understand the concept of the Constitution. I know where you're going with this, too. I mean, it's been argued many times, so I won't stop you right there. Just to make a point in this regard, I recognize, and of course we stipulate, and this is what I think everyone here understands principally, that our nation is ruled by the rule of law, which is the Constitution. And unfortunately, we have circumstances that are presently the case where the Constitution is not being respected even by our governing authorities. The question that comes up in this regard, the reason I wanted to kind of jump this a little bit is because, you know, there are individuals who will say, I have to be obedient to the Constitution, but if a governing authority, whether it be from the president on down to a police officer, whatever, is not abiding by the Constitution, then I don't have to obey him. So I acknowledge that concept. I question it to a certain extent. I'm not sure that's where you're going, but I understand the concept of rule of law that you're establishing here. I want you to go back to verse 3 of the text. And this is something I just want to remind you of. It's a little bit difficult, and basically it is more difficult in regard to interpretation of these concepts because of the fact that we're living in a constitutional democracy or republic instead of under the tyranny of a dictator. But you'll notice in verse 3 it says rulers. And when you look at these things, the authorities are appointed. When you look at the Old Covenant with regard to Israel had a law, the law of Moses, and yet it had kings that were, many of them, the majority of them were idolatrous and led the people astray. Often, but you'll notice the use of the individual under consideration here. Authorities, verse 2, verse 3, rulers are not a terror to good works but to evil, and rulers praise, verse, the last part of verse 3, he is God's minister to you for good. So I want to kind of keep in mind that we need to be careful not to be willing quickly to disobey the civil authorities because we have a disagreement with the civil authorities about what is constitutional, what's not constitutional. Let me give you an example. There are people who argue today, and I think that they may have some justification in the argument that they make, that we shouldn't have to pay taxes. In fact, this is not what those young men were saying. We don't have to pay taxes because you know, verse 7, render unto taxes to whom taxes are due is not valid, but because under our Constitution, the income tax is unconstitutional. You know, have y'all heard that argument made that the income tax is unconstitutional? There are individuals who are tax protesters who do not pay taxes and they go to jail because they say the income tax is not constitutional, and they have challenged it in court. Court doesn't recognize it. Why? Well, because it's the government. We want our money. Maybe that's the only reason. I don't know. But as a result of that, they go to jail as a result of it. These same principles apply that are found here. So, what we have is a system of government that has as its basis the Constitution. We have the judicial system with the Supreme Court as the ultimate arbiter as to what is constitutional, what is not constitutional. We often disagree with that. You know, I disagree with the constitutionality of abortion, certainly. But it's something that's legal in our land because, as one of our politicians just recently said, there are no constitutional guarantees afforded to life before it comes out of the womb. I think that's wrong. I think that's a wrong way of looking at the Constitution and the support of life. But, again, that is a legal thing. That's a decision that was made and decided upon by the Supreme Court. So I feel like we've got to be careful as Christians and keep in mind this principle that we've talked about up to this point, that those things that are lawful that I am not compelled to do that would violate God's law, then as a result of that, then I obey. But we must obey God rather than man in that regard. So I just want to make that very clear that, you know, you're walking, I think, on very thin ice if you say, I'm going to be disobedient to the appointed authorities because I believe that the appointed authorities are not maintaining their fidelity to the Constitution itself. You understand the principle I'm saying?
Yeah, totally agree. I don't disagree with the thing. The logical conclusion, as you said, would be, well, resist the authority because it's wrong, not constitutional. That's very narrow-minded. I might disagree with the constitutionality of the thing, as you said, just very briefly to cover it. Income tax originally is not constitutional, but there was an amendment passed to constitutionally allow for it. Okay. So it is constitutional. Now, that aside, if I don't agree with the constitutionality of the thing, I don't resist that authority because he is still that authority, but I have other constitutional means of
protesting. Right, sure. Yes.
Exactly.
And that's a function of our government that we appreciate very much. The right to protest, the freedom of speech, those kinds of things are not everyone is afforded those things. We actually live in a wonderful place as a result of that. Are there other things that people want to raise to talk about? I do want to just make one point about a passage from about in Acts 4 and Acts chapter 5. Acts chapter 5, we must obey God rather than man. I want you to look also at Acts 4 very quickly. I just want to look at verses 18 through 20 and note what this is the first time of the two times that are mentioned in chapter 4 and 5 where there was arrests or were arrests made. All the apostles were arrested in chapter 5, and chapter 4 is just Peter and John. What you notice in verse 18, they called them, these are the civil authorities, commanded them not to speak at all or teach in the name of Jesus. Well, you notice that Peter answered them and said, whether it's right side of God listen to you more than the God you judge, for we cannot but speak the things that we have said. Speak the things that we have, let me go back, seen and heard. So in that example, I want you to note that there are certain things as Christians we are compelled to do. It's not just we ought to obey God rather than man. There are certain things that God requires of us. And if God requires it of us, even if men say, you can't do that, God still requires it of us. Do not be surprised if sometime in the future proselytizing becomes unlawful. It's an attitude that many have today. I invited people to come to Westside and visit, and had a homosexual man ask me, would me and my partner be welcome at Westside? And I told him, I said, yes, you'll be welcome at Westside. We would love for you to come. I said, now, we don't agree with your lifestyle, and I would preach against it, but you are welcome to come and hear the truth preached. Of course, he didn't consider that welcoming, and I understand why he wouldn't. But I was severely castigated by several others, and the attitude was, you can believe what you want, but don't you dare say it. Don't you dare share it with anyone, because you don't have the right to. It's not force us to agree with you. You don't have the right to speak to where we have to listen to what you have to say. That's where it had gotten with this particular individual, and that's kind of where our society is to a certain extent. But I'm compelled to. So even if it became illegal, that would be an example of what I must do. Yes, Brad?
Well, I think looking at these scriptures, we've got to keep in mind that the authorities that are being spoken of in these scriptures are no longer with us. God is in control of governments. He raises them up for his purposes, just as he raised Babylon and he raised Assyria for his purposes, and he'll bring them down in his time. And when any government, be it Nazi Germany, Soviet Union, whatever, when God is ready for them to fall, they'll fall. Our own government, if it becomes wicked to the point that God decides it's time to bring it down, he'll bring it down. And, you know, it's history reveals this to us.
Sure.
We have to keep in mind our authority, and it's not our duty to overthrow that government. And our own country being born in revolution, our state, our country, born in revolution, each formed a government in those revolutions, subject to that government. And, you know, we have to recognize that. You know, were we in 1776, would we be in violation of these scriptures by fighting against the British? We formed a government, the United States. So therefore, we were subject to the United States. So God will bring wickedness down in his time.
Just to acknowledge that point in Acts 17, that's exactly what the Apostle Paul had to say in his address on Mars Hill. In verse 26 of Acts 17, he said, "He has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings," indicating the extent of their rule as well as the extent and time of their rule is determined by God. I'll give you just two quick examples, Assyria and Babylon. These are two nations that God allowed to maintain their authority despite their ungodliness until such time as they judged his people. And Israel, as bad as Israel was not as bad as the Assyrians. But God used the Assyrians to judge his people and allowed that to go on as it served his purpose. And God is the one who makes those determinations. Something to keep in mind. Dick, did you have something? We're about out of time.
It is brought out that at the time this was written, that they were governed by kings and emperors and governors and such. Probably, you can call them dictators back then, but and most of them were ungodly. There were some godly, like King David and others. But one that comes to mind was with Herod, and how he took out a whim to beheaded John because he wanted to go back on his word and such as that. And they were still supposed to respect him, even though he was a heinous pedophile. He was also to be... they respect him. And like bring that today, we have this liberal regime that condones homosexuality and abortion and same-sex marriages, transgender thing, and all those other immoral things like that, and including our president. And that fact even promotes, encourages homosexuality and abortion and same-sex marriage and all these other things like that. But we're still to have respect for those in authority. It's kind of hard to do these days, but even so.
Yeah. We talked about it as a nation, there are laws that afford us the freedom of speech and the right to protest. But as Christians, we need to keep in mind that our rights, again, as we've talked about it to this point, are not determined authoritatively and in the end by what the Constitution says. It's by what God says in that regard. So, it's a very common aspect of our discourse today that there is no respect shown for those we disagree with. And there is no expression of love that is shown for those that we differ with. And unfortunately, and I see this, of course, social media is an example of this, where Christians are not expressing love and having that right and proper discourse with regard to our disagreements. And Christians can't act that way. We were talking about with the protest, the very latest thing was Colin Kaepernick not standing during the playing of the national anthem. And people say, well, that's his right. It's his right. But it's also our right to disagree with him. And so people just absolutely, virulently attack that. And just, you know, name-calling and evil-speaking and death threats and all sorts of things that come as a result of that. Of course, some of that you don't have the right to in the law of land either. But the point is, as Christians, we must comport ourselves with dignity, with a love for our fellow man, and with righteousness. And I'm afraid that sometimes as Christians, especially, you know, with the conservative values that we hold that are so out of touch with our society, that we will rail against those in authority because we have a right to constitutionally, and don't keep in mind and remember that our conduct ultimately must be limited, you know, how we conduct ourselves and how we act by what God says, not just what the Constitution says, but that's the higher authority. All right, appreciate very much the interesting discussion on this. We're actually next week going to get into discussion on fellowship in Romans 14. We've talked about that so much, I don't want to spend weeks and weeks and weeks doing it, but I do want to go over the material because it is a major doctrine that's found in the 14th chapter. So we'll pick up there next time.